Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Adria Breyer, a member of the club's Health and Medicine member-led forum. Now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Dr. Walter Bortz. Dr. Bortz is a clinical associate professor of medicine at Stanford University School of Medicine and a graduate of Williams College, as well as the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. Recognized as one of America's most distinguished scientific experts on aging and longevity, why are we all here? Dr. Walter Bortz's research has focused on the importance of physical exercise in the promotion of robust aging. Dr. Bortz has published over 130 medical articles and authored numerous books, including We Live Too Short and Die Too Long, Dare to be 100, Living Longer for Dummies, and Diabetes Danger. See the Longevity Library site and the store site for more information. Dr. Bortz is past co-chairman of the American Medical Association Task Force on Aging, former president of the American Geriatric Society, and is currently chairman of the Medical Advisory Board for the Diabetes Research and Wellness Foundation, as well as a senior advisor to Healthy Silicon Valley, a community collaborative effort which addresses the soaring incidence of obesity and diabetes. His presentation today is based on his new book, Next Medicine, which is available for sale today. He shows how the defects of American healthcare threaten the stability of the nation. He argues that the financial interests of biotech and drug companies have eroded the values of the medical profession and placed profit before human being. To his point of threatening the stability of the nation, the head of the Office of Management and Budget, who is a brilliant man of the United States, said a couple of weeks ago on the Charlie Rose Show that regardless of what we do as a country, if we don't get our health care system under control, then we're just going to continue going downhill. So to that point, we have Dr. Bortz to thank for taking us in the right direction again. In terms of the emphasis on aging, longevity, and staying healthy, he and his wife have both at the 100 miles, the Western 100-mile marathon, which needs to be done in 30 hours. 100 miles in 30 hours. And then on his 80th birthday, he's going to do another marathon. I think we have an icon in front of us who we can absolutely mirror. I wanted to tell you something else. In his other book, of which we should probably have this one as well, there are two quotes that just absolutely touched me, and they ring true for who I think Dr. Bortz is. Out of all the quotes, he has two, one by John Lennon, life is what happens to you as you're making other plans. I love that. And the other one is this little boy, Johnny. Mother walks into the room and says, Johnny, what are you doing? And Johnny says, God, Ma, if you must know, I'm drawing a picture of God. And the mother says, well, God, how do you know what God looks like? Nobody knows what God looks like. And Johnny says, they will when I get through. Dr. Bortz is going to tell us how we can get to where he is and beyond. I give you Dr. Bortz.
Thank you very much, Adrian. Well, welcome, everybody. I'm very happy and excited to be here. Commonwealth Club again. I guess it's my fourth opportunity here. And I love it. I love what it stands for. I love the people. Your brain feels more alive at the Commonwealth Club. So it is a venue that I take very seriously, and I'm anxious to expose you to my new book, my magnum opus book, the book that I've been rehearsing for my entire life. I've written six previous books, four on aging and two on diabetes, but this is the book that I have lusted for because it's my profession. And so before I display myself as a rank anarchist within my profession, I should tell you that my father was a physician. I married the daughter of a physician. We are the parents of a physician. I was named for Uncle Walter, who was a caring physician for the gentle people of Greensburg, Pennsylvania, for 70 years. So I hold my profession very dear. So when I stand here and label it as grossly defective, it is not out of any sense of disloyalty or lack of respect. I respect it categorically. But I don't think I need to convince anybody here that we're in big league trouble. And it's getting worse. I probably have in my library now 50 books within the last 10 years of describing it. And one way I have of conveying that is symptomatology. What are the symptoms of medicine? And indeed, my book, Next Medicine, starts with the symptoms. And they start with cost, and then fairness, and then corruption, and then exactness, efficiency. And so one trails right down this list of symptoms, and any one of them is enough to blight an important element such as the medical system. But taken together, they represent an anathema that all of us recognize has to be changed. So I have exploited my unique perspective as a geriatrician. A geriatrician is a physician who's charged specifically with the medical care of old people. And that platform I use very particularly to address Next Medicine. I gave a talk before the American College of Physicians in Philadelphia in June called Geriatrics, the Gateway to Next Medicine. What do I mean by that? What I mean by that is that aging is not a disease. It's not curable. It's not something that lends itself to a medical approach, which is the actuality of most of what's out there right now. So if you would say that one of our two big challenges, aging and diabetes, are the two things that are swarming our world, and medicine is incompetent addressing them. So you can spend the rest of all future treasuries on diabetes and aging, and you're not going to cure them because they don't lend themselves to cure. So just a moment to tell you about Oxford University Press. My other books I have had published by Bantam, by Wiley, by Simon & Schuster, by good publishing houses. And I've had good success, probably a couple hundred thousand books I've sold. I brought some of mine there to be hundreds just because my new book's not going to be available for some months yet. But I went to Oxford because I wanted the gravitas that comes with Oxford. It is the prestige house. And I've known that, and I wanted this book to be there. I want people to salute when they get through reading this book. So I went to Oxford 3 or 4 years ago, and I have access to them, and I presented my thesis to them, and they said, that's terrific. We really look forward to that. And I've reviewed for Oxford. So what they do, and this is what drives me nuts about Oxford, is it send it out for external review. And they have lists of their people. And so they take my book and send it out to half a dozen people and say, what do you think of what Bortz has to say here? Well, like other things, it comes back with mixed messaging. Some people love it and other people hate it. An inside story is that one of the reviewers is a man by the name of Alan Enthoven, whose name you might recognize. Alan is a big medical economist at Stanford, and he gave Margaret Thatcher the National Health Service. It's the Enthoven program in the Netherlands. So Alan is one of the world's premier, and he was my friend and patient. So Oxford sent my book proposal to Alan for review, and very nicely he said, oh, what a great book. You need this book. But on the other side of the ledger were some people from the other side said, this guy's blowing weed. He really is over his head, don't pay any attention to it. So it comes back to Oxford and said, do it over, kind of. So I do it over once, and that's done over once. And I bring it back for another review. Oh, you know, they send it out for review again. And after a second rank, they say, well, you've still got a lot of work to do here, Doc. And so send it out for another rewrite. Each of these costing me personally $5,000 or $10,000 to pay for this next reviewer. But I was so intent on having an Oxford credential that I said, I'm going to go where they insist that I go. So I'm through my last review, I hope. And so what's coming out is my book called Next Medicine. Now, the subtitle is interesting. because my subtitle was The Science and Civics of Health. That's what I submitted it. They said, that's not a sexy title. So their title was The Coming Revolution That Will Save American Healthcare. I thought, whoa, if Oxford is ready and able to go out there and be so bold on their label, then I'm excited about that. So we're still negotiating. I think that's still overblown as a subtitle. But nonetheless, I will have an Oxford title in my bibliography, and I'm very proud of that. So let me give you a précis of my book. And it is really a product of this book. So many of you know this book, Thomas Kuhn's Structure of Scientific Revolution. If you don't have it in your library, you should if you are a historical-minded. Thomas Kuhn, K-U-H-N, was a medical historian at the University of Chicago 40 years ago. And he was under Conant's direction, and he wrote this book, The Structure of Scientific Revolution. He said, the premises of this book are, whenever a populace recognizes that there's an important, vital social structure out there that is not meeting what the needs of that structure are, it must be addressed and redressed. And he uses the colonies at the time of the revolution. King George simply was not to be tolerated any longer, and so a revolution was called for. And we said there are two prerequisites in order for this to happen. First is you need a general consensus among all the parties involved that a revolution is necessary. So you have to have South Carolina and Massachusetts and Vermont all signing on. You couldn't have two or three on and four or five not on. So you need a general consensus first. But the second part of his prerequisites is more important and I think more cogent to my book, is that in order for us to replace a defective paradigm, and that's his wonderful word, the paradigm is this organizational entity, in order to replace a defective paradigm, one is not sufficient merely to displace it. One must have a replacement paradigm of equal power and relevance to put in its stead. Now, if you take the American healthcare system, that is a precise rendering of our history because, as you know, we've been debating this health stuff since Teddy Roosevelt, and all six or eight of our presidents since then have stepped to the plate and usually struck out. First, there was not a consensus among the participants. The doctors were mad at the insurers, and the insurers were mad at the drug people. And so there was gridlock, and I guess Hillary's effort was the most outrageous example of that. So there was never any consensus at all among the participants. So that's a blight on it. But now there is a consensus. And Peter Orszag was the individual who was being cited previously, and I spoke with him at Stanford recently, and he said exactly what my introducer said, that until we get this thing organized, forget the rest of the business of America. We can't possibly exist as a culture, as a society, until we get the healthcare mess because it's paralyzing and destroying. And now we have the AMA and the drug people and the hospital people and the insurers. They're kind of grudgingly putting their name on a document saying, yeah, we have to change. Now, certainly there's not an acclaim of a single postulate. But I come charging along now with the second part of it. And the second part of it is the proposal of a paradigm that replaces the present paradigm. And the paradigm that I suggest and insist upon is health, instead of the current paradigm of disease. Because what we have now is a disease industry, an illness industry. We spend $1.8 trillion a year, almost 20% of the GDP, on sickness. Less than 2% on prevention. So the entire circumstance is so weighted to treatment, to repair, that we have abandoned prevention. Now, I invoke some wonderful Greek stuff in this, and Asclepius was Apollo's son, and Asclepius was anointed by Apollo, being in charge of mankind's health. And Asclepius, in turn, had two daughters, Hygieia and Panacea. And Hygieia was in charge of health preservation. Balance, the golden mean, that was her preachment, keeping all the vital humors in a proper relationship. And so the entire early Greek effort was balancing the humors, the black bile and the yellow bile. So that was Hygieia's job. Panacea's job was repair once something would happen. But of the two, Hygieia was esteemed the more important to be healthy than to fix it after it's happened. So now, as one quick surveys the medical history, one sees, as in Lewis Thomas's book, Medicine, the Youngest Science. Think on that. And in his book, Medicine, the Youngest Science, he says, mathematics goes back to Babylon, geometry and so forth to Archimedes, science to chemistry to Lavoisier, physics to biology to Darwin. So all of them have real wonderfully rooted credentials that go back centuries. But you know when medicine started? Medicine started in 1845 with Mr. Pasteur. Pasteur was the godfather of medicine. Because until Pasteur, illness, death, was owned by the church. Illness was a result of metaphysical interruption. If you sinned, or if you didn't give enough in the donation plate, we'll send you a little cholera to keep you happy. So the church used this threat of illness as its ownership, and it owned health. Ignatius was known for deriding any experiment. You have to go on belief. So it was all metaphysics until Mr. Pasteur came around and said, no, it ain't. It ain't sin. It's a bug. So as soon as illness became tangible, became a realism that was susceptible to human analysis and approach, modern medicine was born. Now, it took therapy another 50 years until the Germans found the sulfa drugs and Fleming found penicillin only in 1935 or 40. So American medicine had no legitimate treatment. Insulin was discovered by Banting and Best in 1922. So just a flash of time ago, there was no science to medicine. So it's a brand new science. So it was born in the era of infection. 99% of humans died of infection. Smallpox, cholera, diphtheria, scarlet fever, just rampant through the world. And fortunately, they were susceptible to a doctrinaire treatment. So medicine started to look pretty good because we could treat something. And we got great kudos for that. And at that moment, we founded the NIH. And instead of spending 2% of GDP, we now spend almost 20% GDP on repair. So within medicine's black bag, it has two tools. It has surgery and it has pills. Now that is a reality. And the reality is that we can charge for that. So our present problem in medicine is an anachronism. We have a medical system that was born in the era of infectious disease, which we could treat with a very identified chemical, get rid of those bacteria, and your fever goes down and you're well. Thank you very much. Move on. So that gave us a celebration of competence that we never had enjoyed before. So we were celebrated. When I was a young doctor, graduated from medical school in 55, our competence was very marginal. We did some good, but not very much good. Then we got rid of infections. I remember as a kid I was sent to the Jersey Shore because of polio. They thought that polio was some vapor that would come under the windowsill at night and take their little boy off paralyzed or dead, because we didn't know. So our knowledge has expanded manifestly. So we're in a new era. And this new era became most apparent to me when I was lecturing in Nashville, and I've had the wonderful opportunity to lecture down at the Meharry Medical School in Nashville now on three separate occasions. And when I did the first one 6 or 7 years ago, I was standing in the lecture hall, and out in front of me was a second-year class, black. Meharry is one of the only two black medical schools in the country. Female, young, southern. I was white, male, north, and old. So the juxtaposition between their demography and mine was immense. So I said, who was I when I was a second-year medical student? What was I about? Well, I was back in the mom and pop, very generous. My wife's daddy was a GP in Boston, and his entire accounting system was his table in the drawer, in the hall, and it was stuffed with crumpled $5 bills. Now we need accountants to keep track. Now we have the medical industrial complex. So I grew up in this very innocent, cost unconscious era. Now we have this whole vast enterprise. And that's where these young women are going versus where I was. So I was struggling with these juxtapositions between their life and what my life was 50 years before. And what came powerfully to me was the recognition that despite all this cataclysmic upheaval, one thing hasn't changed, and that is the mission of medicine. So I resort again in kind of a Greek way to first principles. First principles are those idioms from which everything else derives. That's a first principle. So what is the first principle of medicine? Why is there medicine? I had a good friend, his name was George Sheehan. Those runners of you among you know who George was. George was a cardiologist from Red Bank, New Jersey, and he gave up his cardiology practice when he was 55 to preach the gospel of fitness. And George and I were very close friends, and he got a prostate cancer, and I helped him die. And he wrote a book called One Man's Journey to the End of His Life. And in it, he muses about his childhood. He said, when I was five, everything was wonderful. Mommy was great, and Daddy was great, and my rabbit was wonderful, and the bed was dry. And life was terrific when I was five. And he said, and then I turned six, and nothing's ever been the same since. He said, what happened between five and six? And he said, I pondered that. And what it eventually came to me is that when I was five, I kept asking, why mommy, why daddy, why ever? And I turned six, and it suddenly became how. How do I? And the difference between why and how characterizes that developmental moment that is life-changing. And the why of life, Nietzsche was quoted in Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning, a person who has a why in life can put up with any how. So the difference between why and how is time. The hows are the proximate issues. How do I get across the street? How do I pay this bill? How do I get through today? The whys are the step back, and what is the context? What's the meaning of what we're about? So this is what was running through my mind with these medical students. What's their meaning? What was my meaning? What's the meaning of medicine? And I don't think in my 70 years in its embrace I've ever seen a categorical statement of the meaning of medicine, the mission of medicine. What's the job description of medicine? So I made one up, and you can either accept or amend. And my mission for medicine is the assertion an assurance of the human potential. The assertion and assurance of the human potential. Know what your nature is, what has been deeded to us by 250,000 generations of trial and error. But to nurture is given this as your blueprint. How do you get that blueprint to your potential? So my statement to these students and in my book is I say the mission of medicine is the assertion and assurance of the human potential. That's where we should be. That's the first principles from which everything else should evolve. Now, my view of what's going on in Washington is that it's timid, it's confused, and it's superficial. They're not dealing with first principles. They're kind of dealing with political realities. How can they patch and mend this thing? But until they get down to the mission of medicine, are we asserting the human potential and assuring it? So, again, as a geriatrician, I have some vanity that our people have done a damn good job of asserting what the human potential is. When I was a kid, when you were kids, we didn't know how long we could live. Can you imagine that? I mean, here we have been around for 250,000 generations. We didn't know how long a human life was. Can you imagine going that far as a Homo sapiens, supposedly knowledgeable, and not knowing how long our fuse could last? Now we know how long we can live, given to us by Madame Calmont, who died at 122. So we know the horizontal dimension of life. What a gift of life that is, to know how, where our borders are. But more important than the quantity of life is the quality of life. So once again, I turn to geriatrics as being the essence of that, because until you know the end of a story, you can't know the story. If you leave a ball game in the third inning, or if you leave a play after the first act, a symphony after the first movement, you got to know the whole thing. Now we know what the end of life can look like, what its shaping moments are. I had a brilliant moment when I talked to Marie Garibaldi. Marie Garibaldi was the Chief Justice of the New Jersey Supreme Court, and she was ruling in the matter of Farrell et al. Farrell was one of these unfortunate ALS subjects who was dying incrementally as her paralysis went up. Couldn't breathe. So she was being sustained by tubes. She says, "This is inhuman. I request the court to allow me to die, to disconnect." And Garibaldi, in her assenting opinion, said, "Matters of fate have become matters of choice." Now, to me, that was perfect. Matters of fate have become matters of choice. And what does that mean is that we just now, in the history of mankind, know the difference between what we must accept and what we can change. Can you imagine what a strategic moment? I mean, talk about tipping points of immense intellectual and philosophic significance. Fate has become choice. So we could keep this poor, unfortunate woman breathing for decades. So it forces a reality brought to us by knowledge. So these students not only have great volumes of new knowledge, but they're spending huge amounts of money. So has that translated into our benefit? So my recognition is that it hasn't. So my book says we now know how long life is, and we can know what the shaping forces are. I wrote a paper, and there may be some copies of it, called The Biologic Determinants of Health. And it's helpful to me to lecture on this because health depends on four determinants, four basic first principles. Think of it, a car: design, accidents, maintenance, and age. Same for us. Design, are you a lemon? Are you coming out the birth canal? I mean, there are genetic illnesses. Now, fortunately, we are so incredibly perfectly made that far less than 1% of human illness is monogenic. So our design is damn near perfect. So we can kind of put a low exponential on accidents. What are accidents? Accidents are those things we talked about earlier: infections, malignancies, accidents, wars, toxins, things that have killed mankind largely until now. Accidents are those things by which a person themselves is not intimately involved in the behavior. It happens extrinsically. So accidents happen. I review my own medical history, and a tree fell on me and busted four ribs and punctured my lung, and I needed my lung expanded. I've spruced up my neck body surfing in Hawaii. I've pulled my Achilles tendon off skiing. So the bulk of my medical history have been accidents, and maybe that's the case for yourselves as well. So that's reality, so honest. But it's the maintenance that is the critical one. And how well we maintain ourselves, the choice, is a 30-year age difference. A fit person of 70 is as an unfit person of 40, having nothing to do with genes, having nothing to do with accidents, having to do with differential gene expression. Every one of our 10 trillion cells has within it, every cell has 30,000 genes. Genes are switches. And these switches are not on off. They are rheostats. So they're tuned to the energetic form in which they live. I wrote an article called Exercise as the Oboe's A. I'm a classic music fan, and I've been at so many concerts, and you're sitting there, and the orchestra's out there screeching and thumping and raising hell. And then the concertmaster comes out, and the oboes, and everyone then conforms around that A. So we live in an energetic milieu to which all of our cells, our receptor sites, cue, and we are all demeaned by that. So when we're fit, all of our genes are in the right posture. We live to be 100. 100 is not a Willard Scott curiosity. It's our biogenetic potential. We ought all live to be 100. If we cue our gene repertoire to the right tune. And then there's aging. What is aging? Aging is an assertion of the second law of thermodynamics. Everything goes to hell. Everything in the universe ages. Canyons age, Chevys age, tadpoles, redwoods. Everything ages. We age. What age is that tax on being alive. Because being alive is metabolism. It's chemical reactions. And the free radicals are these little molecular terrorists that are inevitably generated by chemistry. So breathing, we're generating free radicals. Now, fortunately, when you're fit, your enzymes get rid of those free radicals. So the net burden when you're fit, yes, verily, you are generating more, but your net burden is less. Good example is your pulse rate. When I'm running up a hill in Portola Valley, my pulse is 120. What are you using up those pulses for? But as I stand here in front of you now, my pulse is about 45. So the net burden on the body when you're fit comes to the higher potential of being alive. So my book then asserts that we have to get out of the repair business into the prevention business. And until now, prevention has been a platitude. Health has been a platitude. Gesundheit, good health, good luck. But we didn't know what health was. Now we know what health is. Richard Dawkins was over for me at Stanford a while back, and he wrote a book called Unweaving the Rainbow, and in it he uses the story of Keats's Ode to Lamia. And Keats took Newton to task for unweaving the rainbow. Because Newton got his prisms out and said, yeah, the left side has so many angstroms and the right side. And Keats says, why do you do that, Newton? Why don't you just let the rainbow be a rainbow? This is ephemeral glory that we exalt. And Dawkins says, wrong. He says a rainbow achieves higher status by knowing what it is as well as the aesthetic understanding. So I use that same argument for health. We've not known what health is. Now we know what health is. Health is how these various factors interplay the behavioral texts that I just laid out for you. So it lends itself to a prevention model instead of a repair. And I can entertain you for weeks about what people say about repair. And I say, but you get the same thing with exercise. And they say, but there's no money in it. So what we are forced with in our whole medical thing is a massive collision between the first principles of health that we've been talking about. What is health? These energy flows. And capitalism. Now, I'm a capitalist. We all are capitalists. We need to make a profit. But should we not have health as our profit rather than disease? Because right now, our medical system wants you to be sick. If you bleed, that's a country club payment. If you leave my office without a prescription in your... Shit, that's not a good doctor. I didn't get a prescription. Or if I didn't get operated. So we've come to... Now, the translation of that at the basic level comes down to the locus of control. One of my favorite lecture opportunities every year is the second year. It's the Stanford Summer Executive Program in the business school. This is a very fancy-dancy thing. And they have 150 of these birds that come in from Rio and Hong Kong, and they charge them $50,000 for a five-week program to come to the Stanford Business School to learn how to get richer. And they have all these fancy economists there, and I give the first lecture. I said, what's the most important asset in your life? You can only have one answer to that, it's health. And who owns that asset? And you have to answer, you. But people have not accepted that. And we in medicine don't want you to think that because I want you to think that I own your health because I can charge you for that. But that's so antithetical to first principles. What we should want to do is to assert and assure the human potential. The human potential is 100 vibrant, productive, fertile years. And we in medicine don't get paid for that. So my scenario in my book is to clone Kaiser. Kaiser has it right philosophically. Health promotion, health preservation. Pay me on the 1st of January a set fee, then everything else that happens is on my watch. Then I'm going to work for you. Make all the incentives in a line. As it is right now, I want you to bleed. And that's how can I discharge my responsibility of assuring the human potential if I want you not to be as good as you can be. So I have in my book laid out all of these preventive strategies. Heart disease preventable, cancer. Walter Willett, the head of public health, School of Public Health at Harvard, says 95% of cancer is preventable. But the entire cancer phenomenon are therapists, surgeons, chemotherapists, drug people. Nobody's out there trying to prevent cancer. They're all so busy treating it because you get paid for it. So that translates into the very fabric of who sits on the councils at the National Cancer Institute. It distorts every part of our medical environment. At Stanford now, we have a guy by the name of Jerry Kasirer. Kasirer was the editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, a credential above which there's none higher in American medicine. He wrote a book called On the Take. It's out there. He said, the entire medical system is corrupt. Start at the head of the NIH to the deans of the medical schools, the heads of the department. They're all out there because their department does better. If the drug company is kicking in $100 million, $200 million, and this whole UC thing down here south of Market, all drug money. So do you think that's the human potential, or is that a profit for the... I wrote a paper in a JAMA called Disuse and Aging, and in it, my introduction to it, I said there's no drug in present nor prospective use that holds nearly so much promise as a lifetime fully lived physically actively. And that sat fallow until this Medicare drug bill came along. And I was frosted by that. So I called Feinstein up, whom I know a little bit, and I said, Diane, this thing is a disgrace. The only people this bill's going to do any good for are the stockholders of Merck and Pfizer. It's going to cost future Americans trillions of dollars, and old people don't need to take a pill. They need to take a walk. She said, don't talk to me about that. Call up Graham. Robert Graham was the Democrat from Florida who was the principal architect. So I get on the phone and start haranguing his health staffer, Howie Foreman, and he said, stop, Dr. Bortz. Of course you're right. We know that, but we just got 30 million emails from the AARP insisting that we pass this bill. because the AARP is in the drug business. That's America. That's the way it is. So what are you going to do about it? So my thing, my next medicine is kind of clear the slate. Go back to first principles. If we say that we need to know what the human life potential is, which I think we pretty much do now, what are the shaping elements? And all of our strategy should go to that. Now, we're spending now trillions on repair, and I'm suggesting we take half of it and give it to education right away. $2.7 trillion, half of that for surgeons and MRIs, give half of it to the education. Because my theme is that medical illiteracy kills more people than cancer and heart. Those people don't own their well-being. If they but knew how to take care of themselves, it's not rocket science. We can live to be 100 if we but honor our genetic endowments. So it's really a very straightforward proposition. I'm very excited about this historic opportunity. I've met with Obama. I was dazzled by him. I know Daschle a little bit, and Daschle was slated to be the Secretary of Health until he stubbed his toe stupidly on some tax thing. But I still have his email, and I want my book to nourish the debate because it is where the debate belongs. It's on the first principles. It's things that we can justify. It's not mystery. It's really very straightforward. It's common sense. And I'll bet if I were to sit outside and take a poll of you, I haven't told you anything you didn't know already. All I have is kind of the credential of having worked on these ideas and kind of put them in a format that I hope is not only attractive but leads to effective policy. So that will be the success for my book. I have people saying, what does success look like? Well, I say success looks like we're able to do for health what Gore did for the environment. Gore started with nothing, but he's got a Nobel Prize and an Oscar to his credit. So I do not aspire to either of those, but I think we're at a comparable story, that health is there now for us to exploit for the first time. We know what it is. We can be healthy by choice rather than fate, and with some opportunity to do so, we in the Commonwealth Club and everywhere can do that. So please look at my book when it comes out, slated now for sometime in November, and I think we have some time for some questions.
Thank you. Phil? Okay. I've asked Phil to give a couple of comments here. He's the professor, and he's been for years the chairman of the Smart Life Forum down in Palo Alto. He's just wants to put this in perspective.
Okay. Well, that was great. I just loved it. I mean, our whole organization in Palo Alto is based on health education, and which sounds very unexciting until you realize that it's a matter of life and death, and it's your life and your death in particular, and also the lives and deaths of the people you care about. And I think, personally, I mean, this isn't going to be particularly helpful to say this, but I'm so 100% behind what Walter said, and it resonates so strong with me. But I'd like to just kind of call your attention to how radical this is and to see if you really can buy it, or if there's any doctors present or any hospital people or any insurance people, I mean, what you would say to this, because this is, if he's right, you're done for. Let me take what I think are the two main issues that he raises, and then just very briefly, and then we'll kind of open it up and I'll run around with the microphone and get your opinions. The first issue is what is health care anyway? Now, you know, we're supposed to be having this big debate in Congress on health care, and as Walter says, that's not what it's about. I mean, they're worried. Yeah, they're worried about who will get access to health care, whatever it is. The doctors will tell you what it is, of course. And then we're worried about who will pay for it and how we're going to control the costs. And nobody has an answer to that. Anybody who suggests one is smashed by the people making billions selling us drugs and surgeries. But, you know, they say, well, you know, good medicine is a matter of life and death. But, you know, even in that statement, The word medicine suggests what? It suggests a pill for disease. Really, the question is, our maxim should be good health care is a matter of life and death. Now, how are we going to get it? Now we come to the second thesis, and maybe there's more other theses, but these are the two that stuck out in my mind that Walter brings to us, and that is, what is the locus of control here? Who's going to make health care decisions for you? Can you imagine making them yourself? Can you imagine, what if I, after studying healthcare and biochemistry and medicine for the last 17 years, since I more or less retired from being a philosophy professor, what if I tell somebody that vitamin D is the single most important thing you can do to ensure your own good health? Now, Walter might say, no, it's exercise, and he may be right, but one or the other is probably the answer. Bill Grant, by the way, is world authority on vitamin D. You don't know that, but he's one of the people that's brought vitamin B back to life, and vitamin D is going to change the world, I think. But now let me come back to the issue. Do you believe that even if you take the half of the budget that Walter suggests we take and put it into health education, that you will want to make your own health care decisions? No. It's scary to be sick. You want to go to somebody who has the answers. And so the first question that I would pose to Walter, and then I'll step back and see what else you all want to say, is, you know, Walter, in the write-up of his book, which I'm dying to get my hands on, says we need a new kind of health professional. Now, you know, I think that's very true. But you know what else we need? We need a new kind of nonprofit organization, I believe, like the Sierra Club, which is supposed to protect the environment. We need a new kind of nonprofit healthcare organization, like Smart Life Forum, which is dedicated to helping people take control. Because if you trust your doctor, you're going to get pills and surgery. And then you go to the hospital and you lose control completely. Okay, so Walter, let me ask you, what is the new group of health professionals that we need?
Well, thank you for those comments. An easy way for me to parry your question was the two trips I've made to Cuba. Mm-hmm. And Cuba, at almost no cost, has better health care than we do. But on every corner is a nurse practitioner. And she knows what's going on. If you're smoking, drinking, beating up on your wife, if you've had a fall, you are directly indexed. No science, no high tech at all. But their data, their Cubans live longer than we, because they're allowing health to assert itself. Now, we have so distorted it by making it medicalized. And all this damn drug stuff, the radio is full of, if you have a little pimple here, a freckle, that might be something that you need our drug for. So we're seduced by this whole environment out here. So we need health educators. Now, the word doctor, am I Latin? Docere, right? To teach. Doctors were originally teachers. So I'm a teacher first and a repair person second. I would much rather you don't get sick, but you don't get paid for that. The whole bargain is so distorted by the finance. Other comments?
Dr. Bortz, you are so provocative and take us to such a different place of thought. I'd like to make one comment to what you said about prevention. There's so much controversy right now with what's going on with mammography. I wanted to say that this is very important, so allow me 30 seconds. On my website, www.thrivinghealthandwellness.com, is a tab called Breast Health. When women examine their breasts, they need to do it in a different way so that it's preventative medicine instead of creating disease and creating illness. The American Cancer Society will only say that there's one cause of cancer, of breast cancer, and they will say that that's radiation. So please, go to the website, go to what Dr. Bortz is saying about this is what they admit. That's the only tie they'll make. Go to what Dr. Borse is saying about prevention and send that around to every woman you know. ThrivingHealthAndWellness.com. Who else has a question?
Have you coordinated at all with Dr. Len Saputo, who has a book out and who spoke in this very platform upon which you're speaking now?
You are the third person this evening that asked that, and the answer to your question is no. I do not know him personally. I would look forward to an opportunity to talk with him. Apropos the mammography, breast cancer, there's a major study done out of Harvard School of Public Health with a National Nurses Study found that nurses who take 2 hours of walking a day have 40% less breast cancer. So I'm a broken record that if there is a therapy for this or a preventive, it has to do with this gene expression stuff. And when we're inactive, everything goes to hell and there's chatter. But when we co-express our genes in this way that we do when we're fit, then we approach our biologic optimum. I have within my book a new specialty advocated, which is preventive orthopedics. Have you ever heard that before? No, it's not in PubMed. Preventive orthopedics. The most important organ in an older person's body is not their heart, lungs, or kidneys, it's their legs. Because if your legs are good, the rest of you is good. And friend at the NIH says that the single most important study you can do for a middle-aged person to predict whether they're going to go to a nursing home is how strong their legs are. So instead of taking your blood pressure, we ought to say, can you get out of a chair 10 times? That will be a big predictor.
It's remarkable to me that there's a groundswell of public opinion for single-payer system. But nobody in Congress is even taking it seriously. So the question is there anything that can be optimistic as long as we have a political system, which I'm not advocating changing, but as long as we have a political system which is relegated to campaign contributions, et cetera, are we ever going to get there to where the drug companies and the medical insurance companies in this particular society, not the other advanced countries, really hold sway?
Well, thank you for your probing, wonderful question. And that's what it comes down to, policy. Policy must be informed. We have not had the science before. Now we have the metrics. Now we can unweave health. Health becomes a science. We can't afford to be losing all our jobs overseas because of health care costs here. General Motors says they spend more on health care than they do on steel. Well, what does that do to our competitiveness internationally? So if jobs are going wasting because of an ineffective medical system, public awareness will come, and particularly as it's informed. That's what I'm hoping, and I take aging. I write a lot now about frailty, and frailty is noodle legs. And if this is who you are when you're 80, you're going to cost a hell of a lot of money, and that's preventable.
I fully support the points you made about wellness, but unfortunately, I recently lost my mother, who was very active and fit, to depression. And I wonder if you could talk to how some of the activities you've proposed could address those issues that affect a lot of people, you know, aging.
Well, I'm sorry about your mom. Unfortunately, that's a common story. I started to run when I was 42. When my dad died, and I was a wreck. I was clinically depressed. I couldn't work, sleep. He was my alpha figure, and I just crashed. But I was mindful enough of the effect of exercise on endorphins. So I ran the Boston Marathon my first year, and I've run a marathon every year for 40 years. So I don't need a physical exam. As I run a marathon, that's a physical exam. I don't need a doctor if I can run a marathon. Now, it's very true that exercise is exactly the same neurochemistry as all these antidepressants. Exercise raises your adrenaline level, endorphin levels. So your mom somehow fell prey to that not working for her. But I think the science is very much that exercise is one of the best treatments for depression. And I always, when I would have an older person particularly who was down, I said, please go take a walk. Take deep breaths. Open up the life to yourself. The depressed person shutters themselves in.
Yeah, Dr. Borst, I'm so inspired by your sharing, and thank you very much. I lived in China for 12 years, and I'm sure you touch upon it in your book about diet. And I was really impressed by just the diet over there, that they do eat a lot of vegetables and very little meat, and you don't see a lot of obesity over there. And you know, I come back here, and we have a diet full of cheese and heavy meat and that sort of thing, and I'm sure that this has a detrimental impact on the health of someone. And you know, fast food, I just can't stand it. And you have, you know, Food Inc. and Food Nation, you know, a lot of literature out there and films. But I'm sure you could probably touch upon something around diet.
Thank you. I lectured in Beijing last year, and you're certainly right. I mean, you don't see many fat people in China, but they're coming. Just like whenever any country becomes Americanized, their waistlines get up. So they have a threat on it. I ran in the Beijing Marathon last year. I was the last person there, which didn't bother me at all. One of my sayings is, it's never too late to start, but it's always too soon to stop. So I tried to get the Chinese to sign on to that. But it's... The National Geographic had a cover story on Globesity. So we're aware of it in America. 20% of Americans are fat, 40%, 80% are overweight. And the CDC says we're the first generation in the history of our country that will live less long than our parents because of the obesity diabetes thing. So that gets your attention. So we have a long way to go. But I think this, at least, we're paddling the canoe with the same direction. And I'm hopeful. Norman Cousins was a good friend of mine. Norman used to say, nobody's smart enough to be a pessimist. So once we know, if you're working from a knowledge base rather than uncertainties, then I feel much more confident.
Yes, I also am very impressed with what you're advocating. But if we're talking about 20% of the GNP, I can't even think of how many lobbyists that represents. That'd be a small nation.
Of course.
It seems like a frontal attack on Congress is just never going to work. They get too much money from too many rich people. It's going to have to be a grassroots movement, and no better place to start it than in California, because we do a lot of that stuff well. You can just see what we're doing on climate change. With a lot of nothing going on, at least in the Senate, but lots of stuff going on in California. So if I may be so bold as to suggest your next book, you've done the why, now it's time for the how.
Wonderfully said. Thank you. I appreciate that. Well, I know George Halverson, who's the head of Kaiser. So I want there to be 1,000 Kaisers. And the problem with Kaiser is they're still immature. They've not shown that it's cheaper to be healthy. Soon, to me, that's the tipping point. As soon as I can have an insurance company and you do what I tell you to do, which is be fit, you're going to cost less. Richard Branson, who's the head of Virgin, has an insurance company in Britain and a health clubs. So if you put in so many hours in the health clubs, he'll charge you less. That's capitalism. Health then pays. We've got to make that curlicue, and until we do, I think we're on the other side of the equation.
I think one important thing is education. I see so many good people that are not aware that they're on the way to picking up diabetes or some very difficult things. And I think that's when you stop. People care about their car, they polish it, and it drives better. But if you can listen to your body, it's telling you something that you should take care of. And it's much cheaper to do that ahead of time.
Right. Thank you. My main clinical escapade these days is taking care of people at the Samaritan Clinic in Redwood City. And every patient's the same. They're all 40-year-old Hispanic rotund women with type 2 diabetes with 4 fat kids, all of whom are going to get diabetes. And she comes to me for one purpose, and that is for me to give her drug samples, which do no good at all. Actually, they're probably bad, but she has it in her mind that I, the physician, I'm going to take care of her diabetes. So she needs health literacy until she learns, internalizes what her lifestyle is. It's hopeless. And she's, the New York Times had a front page story on Medicare. Medicare will pay for your amputations and your dialysis, but they don't pay for diabetes education.
A healthy kid can become a healthy adult. I don't know if you've talked, Don, about the public school system. In many cases, they've dropped phys ed. Now, our kids spend less time in school, number of days, than most other developed countries. We're losing out there. We're also losing out that this cancellation of a lot of phys ed. I think one of the reasons is they don't talk about it. They're worried about liability. A kid's on playing soccer in the golf out on the field, stubs his toe, and the lawyers descend upon the school, a change in tort law. But I wonder if you talk about the importance of that, of having a regimented phys ed.
Thank you, and I heartily endorse that. In my book, I have a phrase that I'm sure is not unique to me called common health. Common health means that it's not doctors. Doctors don't have much to do with health. It depends on the PTA, and it belongs on playgrounds. So Colleen Wilcox, any of you know Colleen? She's a very stalwart Commonwealth Club. She was the superintendent of schools for Santa Clara County. And she came in and started something, Fit for Learning. So all the kids have a curriculum, and they're encouraged to turn the television off, so encouraged not to drink so much pop. So it's getting at the kids again. I absolutely endorse that and encourage that.
Dr. Boers was addressing his book that is about to be published, Next Medicine. Outside, he also has Dare to Be 100, and they're signed. Our thanks to Dr. Walter Boers for his comments here today. We also thank our audiences here as well as those listening to the recording. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its amazing 106th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you all for coming and for listening.